This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
My name is Ryan Huang, Yui Tuan Huang, and I am an illustrator based in Canada. And a lot of the work I do is exploring Vietnamese mythology and history and culture.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you?
I think it depends on, you know, your experience, and each generation has a different experience. For our parents, aunts and uncles, and our grandparents, like, it was about survival. I think for our generation, it was about fitting in with the diaspora anyways, right? And then for the generation below us, I think it's just about continuing on the legacy and like not forgetting what happened before. And even to us, I think like we, I was a boat person, but I was way too young to remember it. So I think it's kind of my duty to know what happened and keep it going, keep the information and the history like alive in culture and stuff, you know?
Yeah, you do a lot of that through your work.
I try to. Yeah, I definitely try to. Because I think a lot of, I've mentioned this before to a few people, I only just in the last 6-7 years have really started to embrace our history and our culture, where I came from. And I think a lot of people in the diaspora kind of go through that, where you're trying so hard to fit in, right? And you just kind of forget where you came from. And that was me. And only in the, like, again, in the past decade have I really started to like make up for lost time. And just pay respect to like those who came before us. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I wonder if that's ever going to go away for us, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a tough one, because I think as the world, especially with the internet, like we came here. You were born in California, though, but like still you had the same experience as I did being like Vietnamese in a Western
for sure.
Country, right? You're part of the diaspora. And I think for us, it does slowly go away with age. I think for the generation below us, I think with the internet, the world has become so small, and there's so much, well, depending on where you talk about, but like, especially in North America, there's so much diversity here now.
Yeah.
I think you don't have to try so hard to fit in. You just kind of have to be yourself in this landscape that's out there now. And it's a lot easier now, I think, anyways.
It is. And I'm always thinking about the future, because I think this sort of like question of reaching back and kind of like punishing ourselves with this, you know, this memory of our parents or, you know, what they went through, it can only go so far. And I really wonder what's around the corner for all of the members in our diaspora. I think about that a lot now lately, because it's wonderful to hear about how people are expressing themselves, what they think about being Vietnamese. But at the same time, there's a beauty to kind of like coming out of that cocoon and, you know, flapping our wings as butterflies.
Oh, 100%, man. Like, I've never felt so like, I don't know, not free, but like just proud to express myself. Like, I'm more unapologetically Vietnamese now than I've ever been in my entire life. You know, like you go through my Instagram and it's just like 90% of my feed is just about Vietnam now. Whereas you go back like two years ago, even my Instagram feed was fucking video games and Marvel movies and stuff like that. And, you know, but now it's just, this is what I want to embrace. This is what I want to share. I want more people to know about it. And this is kind of my way of doing it. But do you feel like, I just wanted to kind of ask you, when you're talking about like, you know, our parents, do you feel there's like that guilt that we didn't endure what they endured?
I used to feel that. And I'm glad that you're asking me that. And I encourage you to ask me whenever you have questions, because I like to answer questions too.
Awesome.
Yeah. And yes, I do think about that. But at the same time, they didn't go through what other people went through, per se. I don't really feel like my parents, you know, I think there's levels to all of this too, right? There's like parents who, you know, one parent was in the re-education system in Vietnam for 6 years, 10 years, 13 years. There's levels to all of this. 3 years at the minimum, when they come out, if they had the means to leave in a certain way, you know, an orderly departure program, you know, that there's different ways that you develop this scar, the trauma, the hate, Sure. So my parents, you know, got out a little bit earlier than most. And, you know, so they came here with a different sensibility, and I want to honor all of it. I want to honor that way of leaving. I want to honor the way of people having such trauma. You know, I've had family members who parents, you know, fathers basically perished in the re-education systems. And so, and then their mom was, you know, six kids and had to like flee a certain way. So there's nuances, and I just hope to show all of it as much as I can.
Yeah, you bring up a good point, because like I always kind of felt like, you know, we went through this shit and it's like, wow, you know, we survived and yada yada yada. And then I started listening to you know, the Vietnamese Boat People podcast.
Yeah, Tracy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And man, the stories on that.
Yeah.
And then I asked my dad like what our journey was like. I was like, we got it kind of easy, mm-hmm. like relatively easy. Like, but then again, but by doing that, now we're comparing trauma, and that doesn't seem right either. It's like, well, I had it bad, but then you had it worse. So I feel bad for you, but then I had it worse than you. So you should feel bad for me. And it's like, what are we doing here? You know, but it does go through my head. I'm like, we're lucky. We're so lucky that our journey was relatively smooth, all things considered, you know?
Yeah, and this is a really important discussion, because it also, inside of our communities, I mean, everywhere from, I'm imagining African-American or Pakistani or wherever you go in the world, there's like levels to everything. And many times I feel like the polarity, the extreme sides of discussions are the only ones that are being covered. And so it's so important to discuss nuances and the in-betweens, the grays of, you know, because that's sort of where most people are living. Nobody, you know, it's just
100%.
Not everybody's living on, you know, the extremes. People are living a lot in the middle. And having that discussion of in the middle, I think, brings everybody closer, not just Black and white or, you know, Asian and Mexican, but within our community, within our own Vietnamese community, it brings us closer.
For sure.
Yeah. Now, I am on your Instagram quite a bit last week, and man, you are a funny dude. I was reading this stuff and I was like, dude, this guy could easily be a comedian writing comedy. You know, it's some fucking funny shit. And it's funny because it's smart and it's intelligent. And
thanks, man.
And I'm like, I was distracted. The art was like, for me, like kind of in the background, I was like reading the captions. I was like, this is some funny shit. It was like, I think you were talking about Lady Chiu and in God, you hit it like twice. You're like, she could have been, you know, it was like something about the heavyweight in the.
It was when she beat Stone Cold for the, even with Vince McMahon there, she took him out. She took both of them out.
It's like a serious drawing or sketch, or because I think you were in the sketch phase. It's like serious. And then I'm reading it, like thinking it's a serious historical like comment, right? And I was like, holy shit, this is so funny. Like, I can't forget the first thing you wrote, but it threw me off. And I was like, all right, that's cool. And then the second part of it was the you know, the WWE part. You remember the first part?
I'm trying to, I can't remember what I wrote for that. I mean, I can bring it up now real quick for you.
You know, I encourage everybody to go. What's your Instagram handle?
It is at Bri Hoang Draws. So BriHoangDraws.
So yeah, not only will you all be blown away by the art, that's why Brian's here, obviously, to talk about that. But I encourage you to write more captions. Your shit's funny, man. And I think
I appreciate that.
That's thank almost you. Like everything, you know, because, you know, the art is just on point. It's just mind blowing. It's fantastic. But the writing is, you know, I came for the art and I'm here to stay because the caption.
Dude, I have like, you know, a joke a week. That's it. Like, I don't know if I could do a whole like Chris Rock hour long.
That takes time. You should put them
it
together.
Takes time. Yeah.
You should string time. This stuff together.
So you gotta laugh at shit too, right?
Yeah. Kebby, but I think your work is so serious. You know, it's like so intricate, and there's a lot of emotions that are, you know, strong emotions. You know, it's like strong. It's like really strong visuals.
Thank you, man. Thank you. Yeah, I feel like just because this work is so like meaningful now, like you kind of compare what I'm doing now, and it's not like I didn't do my best before, but I think when you just feel this attachment to your subject matter and the content you're creating, it just, you know, you just have that extra push to like make it extra special, I guess, for lack of a better term. And that's what I've been doing, like with the Vietnamese stuff. It's just more personal to me, you know, so more comes out of it.
You know, I'm trying to move away from this format of going, you know, chronologically with people's lives. I'm going to go everywhere today because I think.
Yeah, go nuts, man. I'm ready.
Yeah. So when did you start to figure out this style? Because I'm sure you didn't wake up one day right out of school or something going, oh, you know, I'm going to start doing that. And then, you know, I'm going to refine that. I mean, I'm sure it just took. You know, and what leads you down that sort of path where you hone in on this type of work?
So, do you mean like
the style, the images that you, the visuals that you pick, the subject matter?
So the style is, that was like, because when I was in art school, the thing that I know the pressure for a lot of us, not everyone, but for me as well, was to come up with a style, you know,
it's
like you look at all these professionals and like you look at that's instantly that person's, this is instantly recognizable as that person. So you get it in your head. It's like, well, I have to make up a gimmick basically. So my gimmick in college was like these these pattern swirls. And then once I got out of it, it just wasn't working anymore. So you start looking for other influences. And to be honest, not to suck up to her, but my wife was a huge influence on me. We graduated together, and her style was always, I always thought it was really good. Like, she had this fine line between realism and like interpretive. And yeah, she just really like influenced me, and then comic books influenced me. So I just started using more reference from life. I like, that's another thing, actually. Let me just take you off on a little path here. So I came up with this idea of like wanting to be, just being able to draw everything out of my head. Cause that to me was a sign of like a true artist. Like I don't need reference, this, that, the other, right?
Yeah.
Cause that's a skill, man, to like just draw it out of your head. And then, but I wasn't happy with the work I was coming up with. So I'm like, no, man, like, don't feel ashamed about using reference. All the great artists have used reference, and so, a lot of them still do.
Yeah.
A lot of the professional artists I follow on Instagram, they make no bones about like using reference. So I was like, you know, fuck it. Like, I use reference. So that's when my art started becoming what it is now. Cause you can see like the realism. Like, this is definitely not like just, I can't come up with those like realistic lights and shadows in my head. So, and then.
Now, let me stop you there. What do you do? You go into books and you look at Caravaggio and you look at lights. I mean, what are you referencing that you're talking about?
A lot of photographs that, you know, you when I take a photograph reference, I manipulate it, because you don't want to just lift a photo reference. That picture belongs to someone else, right? So you're basically stealing. So I manipulate it. I kind of like Frankenstein it with other things. So it becomes my own composition. And when I can, I take my own pictures for lighting reference, for poses, especially for hands. I hate drawing hands. Hands are hard to draw.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So I try to take my own photos when I can. Otherwise, I just kind of like cull from like reference books or photos, and then change them enough that I'm not just like straight up, you know, lifting someone's photography. Because that's their work too, right? I'm not gonna just, but yeah.
Yeah, it's like every, I don't wanna be so absolutist here, but a lot of art, food, cooking, music, you kind of have to have a reference point. Otherwise it's sort of squishy and, you know, the form's gone and, you know, it's unrecognizable. Like, we can't triangulate that sort of form in our mind when we're looking or tasting or hearing these things. So we need to bring in, the artist, I guess, needs to bring in sort of these reference points to kind of like structurally put things into place, right?
Oh, for sure. Like, everything needs reference. You can't, because like without reference, you're basically creating a new thing, right?
Yeah.
You kind of like have to like, well, using your food example, I know this is sour. It didn't work with this other person's recipe. So I'm going to tweak it. It's a reference point. So the same with art, same with everything creative, I think, needs reference.
And I guess like in avant-garde stuff where things are just like, guys are just flying off the handle and, you know, you just don't recognize it because it's just so new and there's no format to that, that it's a little bit disorienting, right?
Yeah. You're like, oh, that's new. And you know, some people take it right away. It's like this novelty, and that novelty eventually becomes something that is mainstream or just like more general. It's always jarring for sure the first time something's out of the box, but then you also kind of have to at the same time respect someone for thinking that way. It's like, I never would have thought of that.
Yeah.
And I think it's incredible that someone did, and now they've created like a whole new genre of whatever field that they're in, which is amazing to me. I love it.
I think about the Marvel universe, it's just basically lifted religion, right? Like, Catholicism, those are saints. And, you know, we've been conditioned for that, you know, kind of like thinking for 2,000 years. and Marvel, it's just a universe where we're in that world of saints with superpowers.
Yeah.
It's just a different skin.
It's different skin, different time period. It's just like, yeah, modern technology. But we're telling basically the same stories over and over again. Even our own like Vietnamese mythology, heavily influenced by Chinese mythology, was heavily influenced by European mythology, which came from, you know, like Greek and Roman mythology. Like, yeah, you could go all the way back, you know?
And that brings me to this question of these renditions that you have, these references that you have. One thing, like, this is such a weird question, but one thing that I noticed with, I think it's the Lelai and the Hoàng Kim, right?
Yeah.
The face of King Lelai, right?
Yeah.
It has African, for me, African features.
Oh, really?
To me, yeah. I felt like it was just very like African features. And it was, again, strong is the way I describe the art that when I look at your art, it's, and I don't mean like strong, like the technical side is strong. I'm talking like strong, fierce imagery.
Yeah.
And it just conjured up, you know, a very African face to me. So I'm surprised of your reaction. I'm surprised that you're surprised.
Definitely not my intention at all. I was kind of like, I know for one kind of influence, I was actually looking at some samurai warriors, like Japanese, and then just kind of like melding that with like just random Vietnamese faces and just taking features and mixing them together. But yeah, the basis for that was actually Japanese, the face.
Yeah, and I bring that up because images that we associate with in our culture sometimes, whether it's religious culture, like how we depict, what we see depictions of Jesus Christ, you know, this white man who's like clean, you know, like, you know, handsome, right?
Yeah.
Or I've never thought that I can look at a rendition of a king in Vietnam and see this sort of the details of strength, and look at it from a kind of different cultural side. When I think of like an African king, you know, it's just like that kind of, but now that you're explaining that this is no, this is like coming from a very Asian, you know, references that you have. I'm really, impressed because it gives us this other side, this other way of looking at strength and this other way of looking at, from your eyes, from the way that you see the world, totally different from what I'm used to seeing or not seeing at all. I don't remember last time I saw like a king, a Vietnamese king, depicted with that much detail in his face.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, I appreciate that. But I think that's interesting that, you know, you saw what you saw.
Yeah.
And this is such a cliche art thing to say, but like, yeah, the image is there so that the viewer sees what they see, whether it was what the artist saw or intended is kind of, is relevant to a point, but ultimately you want the viewer to take from it what they take from it. And I think that's exactly what you did, right? Like,
yeah,
you associated this power with like an African king and that's what you saw from it. So I think that's cool. I think that's cool that you brought up.
Yeah, because I think, you know, people in my family view the French in a certain way that I don't necessarily see. I don't agree with, you know, and I don't appreciate sometimes the way they see Eurocentric praising and their visual sensibilities for beauty is different, you know?
That's a whole can of worms. that's a topic.
That is a topic. And that's why I wanted to bring it up, because to me, it's always been a topic. It's always been a topic to me. It's always been something that I think about quite often. It's like, well, why do we have European standards of beauty? You know?
Yeah.
And so I look at this king and I'm like, oh, okay, I can connect with this. This is something that I feel like it's different and it's expansive, you know.
Thanks.
Expansive, but inclusive at the same time.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah, I'm glad. Yeah, again, like I'm really glad that you saw something that, you know, I didn't put there, but is there for you. I think that's really cool.
Yeah. One other thing too, I feel like, as I'm going through your stuff, you know, the speed of our scrolling today, our thumbs, we want to keep scrolling really quickly.
Yeah.
And in doing that, I ran out of stuff to look at. Right. So, and I was like thinking to myself, man, this is a greedy way of living, and it's a very shallow way of living. So I literally slowed down and went back up to the top, and I slowly scrolled and slowly stayed within this sort of mindfulness to look at the details again. And, you know, and thinking that some young artists like you should have like an infinite amount of like, you know, work. It was so, you know, I thought about that. I was like, it's really fucked up that, you know, Brian probably spent hours and hours of his life creating this one thing for me to just like scroll through it and get to the next one and expect him to have more content. You know, it's such a, and so I wanted to bring that up today. And I was like, so when people are going through your IG account, slow the fuck down and study and feel what the images are trying to convey to you, not from Brian, the artist, to you, but what do we, you know, I'm just like wanting to say, we just got to slow down and enjoy what the artist, you know, created for us to really enjoy.
Yeah, no, I feel you, man. Like, I totally agree. And I'll admit, like, I'm guilty of the exact same thing. And I'm on this side of the fence of being like, you know, an illustrator, an artist, and creating the content I create. I do the same thing to other artists. I'm like, this is awesome. This is awesome. This is awesome. But that's the, you know, now we're getting to like the way that we consume media now, which is a conversation that everyone's talked about on every, well, form of media, IG, Facebook, podcasts, you know, what have you, YouTube, and you're just expecting these people to put all this work in.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, that was cool. So when's the next one? Like, I do that with YouTube channels. I'm like, oh shit, that's it. Like, no more videos. And then I stopped. I was like, this video probably took them like months of research. Yeah. And like months, hours, weeks, months of like putting together. And I should know that because one of my friends, she's a producer for a YouTuber. And, you know, we talked about it. I'm like, shit, that's a lot of work.
A long time.
Yeah. That's a lot of work. You gotta like really, you do have to stop and appreciate it. Even the shitty ones, you know, even like movies, music, like even if you don't like it, these people put so much work into it. So now I still have my opinions of certain things, but I try to appreciate the work that went into it, you know? So
The future is here. And there's so much content that is being created so often, but I hope as the future is here and we begin to walk into these virtual metaverses that we can also like develop a different way of being, which is the mindfulness of staying put and processing images or sound and taste in a different way. We can slow down a little bit and enjoy it.
Yeah, but I think with the future, just more content is constantly coming out at a faster rate.
Yeah.
So for someone who just wants to see as much as possible, they're gonna do that, and they're gonna be like, again, like, what's next? Because I want to see this, I want to see this, but then I also want to see this, this, and this. And I don't have time to like stop and like, well, smell the roses, for lack of a better term.
But you know what though? I mean, even though we're having these TikTok moments where things are 30 seconds, 2 minute clips, they're very short form, but there's also this proliferation of longer form content too. You know, you see these long form podcasters, minimum of 3 hour episodes now. And then you're like, wait a minute. So 10 years ago, when you first started out, you only did an hour. And how is it that throughout 10 years that things are getting longer for those guys? You know, I'm not going to name names, but there's not just one of them. There's many of these guys that are going deeper and deeper with their guests. And I think that's something, that's a trend that they know something about because they're massive podcasters. There's you know, there's a trend there that's happening that I'm paying attention to because, you know, I'm in the space and, you know, maybe 90 minutes an hour is not enough anymore for some people because, you know, what if there's so many fans of Brian Huang out there that just want to know more, right? Or, you know, in 5 years, you get commissioned by Marvel to create some, and I'm putting it out there, create, you know, these visuals for a Vietnamese Marvel character, and they come to you, and then people are like, all right, let's go back. Oh, fuck, we only have 90 minutes of Brian 5 years ago on the podcast. And so it's, you know, people want to get to know the genetic thinking, you know, of Brian's, you know, art, you know, I'm just putting it out there, but there's a trend to go longer with these sorts of podcasts. And, you know, next 5 years, I don't want you just to be here once. I want to see you back over and over as your art.
I hope so, man. I totally hope so. But kind of going back to what you're saying about like long format, I love like, you know, your podcast, like you do an hour to an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And I love this, like, that is short compared to some other podcasts, but you do get a sense of like the person you're talking to. You know, you get to like, you might not ask them everything, but that I love listening to long interviews like that, where it's not just like, and I know you've mentioned this, a couple of your guests have mentioned this before too, where it's not just like, hey, I'm here promoting this, all right, peace out.
Yeah.
No, you ask them their opinions, they ask you your opinions. I love listening to this shit. Like, I love it.
Yeah, me too. I mean, that's why I'm here, because I feel like the luckiest man in the world, being able to sit with Vietnamese all around the world to hear like your journey.
Yeah, that's another thing. Like, I love that there is, like, I think more are coming out now.
Yeah.
But to have a long format interview on Vietnamese culture that you do, like, kudos to you, man. Like, I love what you do. I'm so glad you do it. You know, thankful. I think a lot of people in our community are thankful for what you do. So,
and I am too. I'm very thankful to be able to have people like you and all these other guests open up. You know, it's a wonderful and it's such a meaningful place to be, to do this work. So thank you.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you about like just some stuff that is on a practical level that I've always thought about and I've always been curious about, which is print numbers, right? Yeah. So when you think, like when you go and you see somebody's in somebody's living room, it says one of, or five or 50/50, right, or 3 of 25, like what can you, I mean, I have an idea, but can you like dig down and explain what that means and why artists do that and what it does to the pricing structure, the economics of, you know, having prints like that?
Mm-hmm. So basically you're creating like a scarcity with the print, right? So, and I'll get into like why I do it, but basically if there's only 50 copies of this certain print of this specific edition, like you could do like a different edition with like a different color or different whatever, right? But this exact edition has only like 50 copies. Art collectors are gonna kind of like, well, I want to be one of the 50 that own it. So yeah, you do kind of like create a scarcity of it, which makes it a little more valuable for art collectors and stuff. I do it, there is that, you know, just making it like a little more valuable to people. Like, it's not just like a digital print that like I can just keep printing in perpetuity. But I also do it because it kind of kicks my ass to like make the next one, because like this print run is going to run out one day, so I need something to replace it. And you know, like a lot of times, you know, being an artist and just creating art should be enough motivation, and it is. But sometimes you do need that extra, like, you know, drive. For me, I'm just speaking for me personally. I can't speak for any other artist. But yeah, I just don't want to like rest on my laurels. And this I've found is a way to not do that. So like this print was really popular. You know, a lot of people bought it. It was great. And I just kind of like just rely on it. I don't want to do that. I want to make something better. And then after that, make something better than that. And like, just keep going, you know.
But pushing. How do you decide if you do 50? Why not just do one of one? Like, people are like, oh, that's a Monet. There's only one of that. But why do 50? Why do 25 of them?
You know what? I don't know. I think I kind of see. I don't know how to answer that question, to be honest.
Yeah, I've always wondered about that. You know, because I'll see it at people's homes and I'm like, why doesn't the artist just make one of them and then move on to another, you know, design?
Some do. Some, I think it just comes down to the artist, to the print, how they feel about it. If they want it to be really scarce or if they want more people to have it.
There we go.
Yeah. I think it's like, there's no like set rule. Like, it's, yeah, up to me to come up with the number that I want to like make a print run of. And yeah, so speaking personally, I don't know why one print I made 100 of and the other I've only made 50 of. Might have been my budget at the time for printing costs.
I see. That plays into it, doesn't it?
For me it does, yeah. I think for some other artists that they it's not an issue, but for me sometimes, yeah, I kind of gotta see my budget for the month and stuff. And
have you ever been sort of like right or wrong about how many you print for a show?
Jesus, yeah. Fuck yeah. it's different for every show, which is kind of keeps me on my toes, but at the same time I'm like, at one show I sold out of this, so I better bring more of that, and this one barely moved, so I don't need to bring a lot of that. The next show, it's completely flip-flopped. I'm like, what the hell? You know, it's so unpredictable. And same with print runs too. Like, I'll do like 100 of one print, and that'll be my print run. And I think it'll sell pretty well and it moves, but then I'll do another one with only like 50 and it sells out in like a month. So it's so hard to like,
to gauge. So
hard to, yeah, totally, man. Totally hard to gauge. It's impossible to gauge. Even with like, you'd think comments on Facebook and Instagram and whatever social media would help gauge like the potential popularity of like a certain print. It doesn't. I'll get like one post and tons of people's like, oh, this is awesome, I love it, yada yada yada. And then so, oh, okay, I'll print more of that. I'll make a bigger print run of that and it sells okay. And then another one, it's like crickets and it sells out. So there's so many factors and you can't know. There's no math to it, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of which, do you, when you started out as an actual business of, you know, art, did you study other, and I ask these things because, you know, for my own life,
yeah,
when I get into different projects, I like to dig into their podcasts and dig into their way of doing things. So I have like best practices understood. Did you go and look at the way, you know, a bigger artists were making their living and sort of emulated? Did you feel like there's a formula for artists to do things in the world that you live in? You know, there's best practices and, you know, I guess I'm asking, is there sort of like a concrete way for younger artists to kind of like take a path where like, okay, this is what you do. This is how we do it in the way that in the world of your commerce, in your niche of the world?
Mm-hmm. No concrete way. I don't think there's a concrete way to do it, especially with social media now. You know, there might have been like a pretty solid guide, not like a concrete guide, like nothing written stone, but there was probably like a pretty rock solid guide for illustrators that came before me. You know, you get a portfolio, you go to life drawing class, get a portfolio done, start illustrating, and then you take it into clients and cold calling and stuff like that, you know, create a mailer. But you always had to take it through the gatekeepers. Now those gatekeepers, they're still there and they're still, you know, like there's still value to like going through big publishers and, you know, distributors and stuff like that. But it is so much easier now with social media that a lot of those shackles have kind of been taken off. So you know, to answer your question, I don't think there's a concrete way, but I would say in today's day and age, social media, just utilize it. Utilize social media, use the right hashtags, you know, get your work in front of potential customers and clients, and they might not be big distributors and big publishers and stuff, but you get enough eyes on it, it might find its way to that publisher that you've been looking for. So I think that's the best advice. I know Instagram has been a huge boon to my work in recent years, for sure.
But you work in 9-to-5, regular, typical art job or something before you stepped off and created your own unique brand, right?
No. I was working in a hotel for 10 years.
Oh.
Yeah. So after graduation, I actually worked in two hotels. Not going to name them because, you know, I didn't have a great time at them.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just like a soul sucking job. Like I was a mini bar attendant, and it was basically 8 hours a day of knocking on doors, asking people they want their mini bar refilled and refilling it if they need it, checking their name off. And you had to do like 90 to 100 rooms a day. Just the same, yeah, the same shit every day. And I mean, there were worse jobs out there for sure. I shouldn't complain because the housekeepers at these hotels, I'll say this to your audience, treat your housekeepers well when you stay at a hotel because they're such hard workers. So they had it way worse than I did. But yeah, there's nothing rewarding about doing minibar at a 5-star hotel at all.
Fucking 10 years, man.
Yeah, 10 years. Doing art on the side, but
yeah,
that was my main thing, basically. Wake up, shower, work, come home, play video games, draw. I would still try and draw, but some days you just couldn't, man. You just didn't have the energy, you know?
During those 10 years, what was going on through your mind? Did you ever see like the future going, okay, on year 10, I'm going to stop this shit and I'm going to go full throttle and I have a vision for myself? Or during those 10 years, did you go, you know, like, what the fuck am I doing?
Oh, definitely. What the fuck am I doing? For sure. Because there was a moment where I was kind of starting to get into like comic conventions and stuff. I'm like, okay, this might be my out, but it wasn't.
Fickle.
Yeah, it is. It is very fickle. And it was just like, it just felt like a hobby. And at that time it was, you know? So, but then, and I know I mentioned this to you on our pre-interview, my wife started doing conventions with me and she started doing the math and she's like, you know, like my work and your work together, we do like at least 10 of these shows a year. Cause I was only doing one show a year just for fun in Toronto, like the local one in Toronto. She's like, if we can like start traveling and start doing these shows, like in as many cities as we can, we could probably like fuck off with these jobs and like do our own work. So, and her work totally carried those first few years for sure. And it still does.
Her artwork or her
art.
Or did, yeah, she have a mini bar job in,
oh,
in
her own? She actually did mini bar with me too. I got her a job in the mini bar. It was like, if I'm going to suffer, you're going to suffer with me. But,
so her work, her artwork carried you for the first.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah. So it was her art that kind of like allowed us to start traveling to all these other shows. And, you know, she built a following. I slowly started building a following in other cities as well, like outside of Toronto. And since 2014, we quit and we just started doing art full time. And that's what it's been since. It's been awesome, man. Like I still, to this day, I've been doing this 8 years now, and I still pinch myself. I'm like, people are paying me for my artwork and it's enough to like live on. It's a dream come true, really. You know?
You know, Brian, I am not there yet, right? This is my second year and I have so much respect for that, because, you know, I can imagine a lot of human beings in this day and age are doing mini bar work. They're doing work. I do menial jobs to feed my family to get to the next, you know, yeah. I want to be at your 2014, you know, where you were and going, fuck it. This is what I do. This is how I make my money, you know? And that is a beautiful place to be, but we all got to fucking grind.
Any
artist, any creative endeavor, you have to grind for 10 years at the fucking mini bar. You have to be a mini bar attendant. And I worship at the altar of that kind of grind. You know, it's a big theme in, you know, my podcast, because you just don't get to be born and do this, whatever that creative endeavor is. You have to find a way to improve your shit to where people want to pay money to buy it.
100%, right? Man. Like 100%. And that's what I mean. Like, there's so many times during those years where, well, you know, like we said earlier, like, what the fuck am I doing? You know, like, I'm my art's going nowhere. I hate this job. Hate's a strong word. The job wasn't that bad, but it definitely wasn't like fulfilling at all. I didn't grow as a person. If anything, I probably shrank as a person. I just became like this bitter, jaded, like, you know, fuck rich people that boss me around, get me this, get me that. You know? But can't remember what I was gonna say now. It's like I got on this rant about working at the hotel.
Hey, this is what this is all about, right? Because we can rant about it. Yeah. You know?
But
talking about the journey, how difficult the grind was. And
the grind. That's what it was. It was like, what am I doing? And I will say, like, I had this stroke of luck of being with someone who was also an artist and had the talent and the guts to say, hey, let's do this. Let's quit our jobs, because we can do this. And she, you know, she pulled me out of that. She pulled herself out of that, and she pulled me along with her, you know? So I know, Jill, you're going to be listening to this. So thank you, Jill.
Yeah, that's everything.
Sure.
That's everything.
But I mentioned, like, even your podcast, you've only been doing it for like 2 years, you said?
I'm at a year and a half.
Look at the guests you've had on.
Again, 20 years in the grind, you know, living, knowing sort of intuitively that I always thought that I would write books about filmmakers, you know, so the weirdest thing, because I'm around those guys a lot. And I thought one day I'm going to just, you know, put together biographies, short biographies, and put in a compilation.
Yeah.
You know, it was the weirdest thing. Like, for a long time, I kept thinking, like, you know, I'll work alongside these guys and one day I'll put a compilation together. So I'll just try to expand the amount of filmmakers that I knew, producers, directors, actors, whatever, writers. And so at some point, maybe 5 years ago, I was like, okay, I see all these big long form guys, you know, in the mainstream. I would love to do that. And, you know, and it wasn't a reality because I suck at technology. That's why this new camera, you know, I was so excited. So
it's all about growth, man. It's all about growth.
Yeah. And just like you, it's, you know, we grind and we grind and we always have, what the fuck am I doing with my life moments, you know, for, and I'm like, you know, my mid 40s having that feeling right now, you know, and, you know, just, I know that if I just keep drawing like you, like, this is my drawing, and just keep sketching, you know, eventually this sort of work becomes the work that you are intended to do for life.
That's the goal, right?
Yeah,
for sure. And I think, like, you know, being in your mid 40s, I'm not much younger than you. I'm 42. I'm turning 43 very soon. And, but then you also look at, like, some actors who didn't get their big break until they were in their 60s.
Yeah.
So, you know, ideally you would like to kind of get into the industry while you're younger. But things happen the way they did. And as long as you get in, your foot in the door in whatever industry you happen to be in, and you kind of get to enjoy it and reap the rewards, I'm okay with like hitting my stride at like 42, you know, like. So
yeah, I agree. If you find the work, because it takes renditions, different versions of your artistic journey or creative journey to finally land on whatever hat you're meant to wear.
100%.
Yeah. And if you enjoy the journey every step of the way, not the mini bar version, you know, of that grind, but if you're enjoying the actual progression of the art and the creative endeavor that you're going after, that makes it bearable. It makes life bearable.
Oh, totally. And you know what? Even with that mini bar, I really did not enjoy it at the time, but I'm so thankful for it. Because when you are past it, you look back at it and you're like, that was, you know, like that was part of the journey.
Yeah.
Like it was a stepping stone. It was in some ways an eye opener that had to happen for this to happen. And I always look back at, I'm being melodramatic here, but I always look back at miserable moments in my life with joy now. Cause even like, and I'll listen to like songs that I kind of tie to that era of my life. I was like, oh, this is like depressing and yada, yada, yada. But now when I hear those songs, they oddly make me happy because I'm past it now. I'm in a better place now. I'm happy now. So it's a reminder of, yeah.
That's such a good thing that you just brought up. You know, these songs that trigger these moments in the darkness.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it gives you this reference point to think back on that, like A to B, right?
Yep.
You know, you think of that song and it's like, that's the A point. And then today is the B point, all the little infinite points that were in between. You're right. I have this one song and it was, I think 1994. I remember having a walk.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow. I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Man, 1994. I was sitting sort of like in this forest area. I was a Marine. I was just coming into, it's the school that you have to go to do whatever MOS, the job that you're in. And Four Non-Blondes was the song that I was, that I had on repeat. I think the song is What's Up. Is that the song? Wake up in the morning and I step
outside. Yeah.
Take a deep breath and I get real high. So that song, as you were telling your story, I'm thinking about that song and I'm like, God, it was so dark. It was one of those moments. I was like, what the fuck am I doing with my life? I was like, it's my 18th week in the Marine Corps. 20th week in the Marine Corps. And it was just like, you know, I didn't know anybody. It was North Carolina. I was in the woods and it was like, you know, one of these evenings and, you know, it's like kind of muggy, kind of, not cool, but it was just like
pure misery for you, basically.
Pure right? misery.
Yeah.
Pure misery. Like, where am I going after this? This is, but when I look back on that song and that song plays quite often, yeah, you're right. It conjures up these different points of like, oh my God, like that allows me to go back to that point in my life and go, I was really like a blank sheet of paper. I was a white sheet of paper. Like I was very moldable and ill-informed and didn't know shit. And I still don't know anything, but I mean, you know, compared to that.
But you do you like find out now when you do hear that song and it does take you back there. Do you listen to it now with like, a bit of like relief and you don't like necessarily enjoy the song itself, but you enjoy where it takes you back and seeing where you are now. Like, does it make you feel happy now to hear it? Because that's what songs do for me. Like,
sometimes I think about my kids when I think about them, and I recently I think about them because I'm like, I wonder and I hope and I pray that they can go through this in a way where, you know, those early years without me or their mother or any guardianship, and they can survive that experience and be okay, you know, because it's kind of dangerous when you think about, you know, obviously a 3 and a 5 year old, you know, I can't think of them being 18, right? I only think of a 3 and a 5 year old as a parent. So it triggers a different part of me now that, you know, like maybe 6 years ago when I listened to that 4-9 Blonde song, you know, it's a different feeling. But now I think about my children and I'm like, God, if they were in the woods and they were 18 at the time or 17 at the time, you know, are they gonna be okay? You know?
That's so interesting that you project, because like, I don't have kids,
yeah.
But as a parent, you basically take in the feeling I get to listening these old songs that brought me back to a, you know, not a great place in my life. And you project it onto your kids and you think about, you kind of put them in your shoes. That's neat. That's really interesting that you do that. I guess that's the sign that you care about them.
Oh yeah. Dude, that's like an understatement, man. I think a lot of us parents are, you know, obsessed with, you know, their safety, how they're going to turn out. You almost, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like my life is already spoken for and, you know, it's all good. And I secretly worry, you know, that if they're going to be fine with the climate change, with, you know, just different crazy shit in the world, you know?
Yeah. Even like, you know, even before, you know, the big talk of climate change and like, you know, the war, the pandemic, all that stuff, I would, because like most of my friends have kids now. So, you know, yeah. I kind of see vicariously sort of like parenting and stuff like that. And then I remember the way my parents raised me. And I know I would just worry about every little thing, everything, like social media, whether they're bullied at school or if there are bullies at school, you know, like I don't want some shit kid to like pick on someone else's kid, you know?
Yeah. But God damn it. Think about like what our parents went through, you know, perils and the crazy journey that they went through. And
yeah, but when did your parents come to the States?
They came in 75. They came. 75.
Oh, so right at the fall? Or?
They left a week before the fall.
Oh, good timing.
Yeah. You know, I don't know how my dad got the inside information, but he was a lower ranking officer. I'm not sure how he got the word, but he knew that this was going to go down on this day. Mm. He sent out telegrams or he sent out pigeons, right?
Yeah.
The proverbial pigeons to his 3 or 4 older siblings and uncles and whatever. There's like 3 or 4 of them saying, hey, I have a boat that's waiting for you down at the, there's a dock like San Diego or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Sort of like that. I chartered a boat. Your families are accounted for. Load up, get your ass down here at the dock. Here's the day. And none of them fucking went. None of them responded. And that is why I sort of have this, like, again, these nuances in the conversation. It's like, I have this like, okay, fuck you then. If you don't listen and if you didn't trust your little Jedi that just gave you a pigeon, right? Then whose fucking fault is that? And then each of those guys, like one guy died in the camp. Another guy did 13 years. Another guy did 6 years, right? And one other guy like narrowly escaped because whatever. So it's like we are making our decisions in real time all day long. And then my dad got on the boat with whatever people that that he figured out and he got out. So it's like at the end of the, and he was the youngest of all these guys too. So I'm at the same time thinking, okay, was it loyalty that kept you from not moving? Or was it, I know judgments, right? I'm just putting it out there. It's like, or were you afraid of getting locked up from your own side, and you know, your command, your chain of command is going to reprimand you, and you know, for leaving your post? Or were you truly somebody who really wanted that power and not want to let go of the power? Right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it
could it's dark when you think about this shit. You know, you're talking about full-board colonels, like, you know, a full colonel, you know, doing 12 years, 14 years, you know, in your mid-30s, you know, and you're in a lot of power. You got jeeps, you got soldiers, you got all these fucking command guys under you. And so your younger brother, your younger nephew, you know, tells you, you know, sends a pigeon out and, you know, and says, you know, leave post, because shit's going to go down and I have a boat chartered waiting for you. You're going to, now, if you get locked up, don't come looking for us. All of these guys were saying that to my dad. If you get locked up, don't come back and fucking, don't expect us to fucking bail you out.
Man, it's a fight thing.
That shit never left my mind. Like when my dad recounts that story, or, you know, he's passed away now, but I never, so my refugee story has its own weird meaning, right? My refugee story is like, if the US ever goes down, make sure that if my brother's in Brazil at the time, or fucking, you know, in Africa or somewhere in Finland, get the fuck out and go. And, yeah, and don't ask questions. Just go. Just, you know?
Like, this is, they're not joking around here, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man, that's.
Yeah, so it affected the way I've lived life, kind of like, you know, I have this nomadic way of looking at life, even though I've lived in LA my entire life and have not left other than the 4 years in the military. But yeah, it's really affected the way I see my world, because I always felt like at any time you'll get the proverbial pigeon and you got to make a decision, you know. I still live with that horror in my heart, thinking about my dad's uncles and older brother and, you know, all these big dug in positions that they all had. Crazy.
I mean, that's what I guess, like, that's kind of like what generational trauma is, right? Like, you don't live it yourself, but your parents live it, and it, you know, it comes out in their daily routines, and you're going to pick up on it.
Yeah.
And then in this case, he actually like told you literally what the story was, and you're like, well, shit. Yeah. No wonder it was like, that's man, I can't get over that. Dude, that is crazy. Yeah, for sure.
So that's crazy, crazy shit. So like when I'm at a concert, I'm always looking at where the exit points are. It's crazy. You know, 80,000 people in the stadium or 20,000 people in the stadium. I'm like, where the fuck are the exit signs? I just want to make sure I got it safely.
Don't go to any Travis Scott concerts, and you'll be fine.
Yeah, man, it's crazy.
Oh, sorry, you just froze up for a second.
I'm wondering what the okay, I think it stopped. Okay, I think we're good. I want to shift gears into crypto and NFT for art. Have you gotten into it?
No. I've had a lot of thought on it. Watched a lot of stuff on it. I still don't fully feel comfortable jumping into it. And I'm not judging anyone who does, because I know there's a lot of hate for it right now. So I'm not jumping on that bandwagon. I'm not jumping on the hate wagon, but I just don't feel that it's for me, especially at this point. There's still too much I don't know about it, even with all the information out there. And I've had some friends that have gotten into it, and it's been great for them. But I don't know, like, there's a stigma attached to it now too, with you've seen like the Bored Ape and that stuff. And I'm not gonna like shit on someone else's work, but this Bored Ape just doesn't, it doesn't feel like art to me. It just feels like collectible this is going to sound harsh, but it just looks like shit to me. Like
Funko Pops.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, I understand collectability and stuff, but it's just, I don't like it. I don't like those Bored Apes, but that's not saying just NFTs and all, like,
yeah, just that corner of the,
yeah. Market. Yeah. There's this like, and that's a huge part of that market. Right. So, and again, like the NFTs that my friend does, they're legit. She puts effort into them. Another friend does NFTs, and he got in on them early, and he does these really cool like skull animations.
Yeah,
they look dope. But then all of popular ones that all the celebrities are jumping on, I don't know, man. They just don't look good to me, and I don't want to like kind of get tied up in that. I don't know. It's hard for me to comment on NFTs without sounding like not shitting on them.
Yeah, I get it. I appreciate your point of view. It's one of those things where we're gonna see where this turns out. You know how it.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing right now. Like I'm, you know, I never say never.
Yeah.
But for the time being, I'm not gonna get into that space. I might change my mind like 6 months from now, a year from now, if things get better in that space, if things are a little more, you know, legit with certain transactions, and there's the environmental impact that everyone talks about as well. I don't know enough about that to get into it. So
the more I think about NFTs, the more I start to drift into this weird world of art and money laundering.
Yeah, dude, for sure. And like art has kind of always been used for money laundering, but now it's on this scale that I...
whole other scale.
Dude, yeah. And I don't fucking get it. I really don't.
Well, okay. Well, let's break this down for everybody. Okay. You don't get the money laundering, or you don't get the NFT and the money laundering, or you don't get the art coupled with the NFT and money laundering. Well, what part of this whole equation you don't?
I think there's just like, okay, I understand money laundering. I understand people do that. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know what to say.
Well, you know? Okay, like, let me ask you this. Yeah.
Yeah.
What were you going to say? Are you going to say something?
Well, I was just basically like, I don't want to like shit on NFTs, but I also don't want to be part of what a lot of it is used for nowadays.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, there's like a lot of scamming, a lot of art theft. That's another thing.
Oh, and, really?
Oh, shit. Tons of art theft. Like people are just pulling people's work off of like Instagram and DeviantArt and all that stuff. And they're just like throwing it up there, and they're selling for thousands of dollars. Just like random people.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And there's nothing
you can do about
it. It's just like, well, your work was stolen. There's shit I can do about it. You know, there's no governing body. There's no, cause yeah, like the crypto space is so, it's unregulated. Wild West. Right? So yeah. Yeah. So who am I going to complain to?
So, this whole thing about, I think it's Hunter Biden, right? Do you follow this stuff?
Not the recent stuff, but I kind of had to take a tiny break from politics just a little bit. But
I think Hunter Biden is the guy that, I think it's Hunter Biden. I'm pretty sure it's him who I think is a decent artist, but his shit goes for millions and millions of dollars, right?
Wait, Hunter Biden's an artist?
Is it Hunter Biden? One of these political
Joe
Biden's Joe's kid, son? Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's got to be Hunter Biden, I think. Yeah, because there's just so much going on around it. So this is what I like. You know, I've kind of been paying attention to. It's like it's one of these guys. Let's just call him Hunter Biden for now. But you know,
yeah, for argument's sake, right?
Yeah, I could be very wrong. So he put something together. He draws something. And he moves it for millions.
Yeah.
It's perfectly fucking legal.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Right.
But here's the thing that pisses me off. Like, if he made it himself, if he's the artist, that's cool. You know, like, get the money, right?
No, but I think he is the artist. But the thing is this. He's in a position in government to take money.
I see what you're saying.
And in any weird capacity like that, like that shit's going on, right? It's dark.
That's another debate right there. Like, I mean, if he's not directly involved in politics, but he can't not be because his dad's the fucking president, right? So it's kind of part of your world. Are you? Oh shit!
I mean, what other thing in the world can you create out of thin air? Put it on canvas, make a sculpture, whatever the fuck you do. Yeah. That you can go, you know what? I want $5 million for that.
Oh, geez.
Right? And then you just take $5 million for that arbitrary creation.
It's not the getting the $5 million for the creation I mind, because that's what art is, right? Like you're an artist, you're a creator, you created something and you're getting paid for it. Now the conflict of interest is like the politics involved. I don't understand the legal stuff around that, so I can't really comment, but
there's nothing anybody can do.
Yeah.
There's nothing anybody can do. It's very fascinating. My
beef is with the people just like taking screenshots of other people's work and them selling it for whatever amount of money, right?
Yeah, that's a different conversation.
This is a different conversation.
I'm talking about like, you know, you're handing over money to a politician in a way that's completely legal, you know, and you change the course of humanity based on this kind of shit, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, shit. I didn't even think about that. I didn't even know he was an artist.
I think it's Hunter Biden. I could be wrong again, like, you know, but yeah,
right.
It's, you know, like this is something that, you know, laundering money in art seems to be something that I've been thinking about a lot lately as I'm, you know, that's why I wanted to bring it up. I was like, do you know anything about this world of you know, how money is exchanged? And I think it's interesting to talk about because then there's a celebratory side of art that can freely pass and artists can make a lot of money because of this way of doing money exchange without taxes and all of that stuff. And, you know, that is a whole episode in itself to discuss that kind of like money movement in the world of art.
Yeah, I definitely, there's so many schemes and scams definitely used for money laundering. There's also, I don't know the term, but there's a lot of creators that buy their own NFT to drive the price up.
Mm.
So, it's legal. It's perfect because there's no regulation. There's no law against that. So there's that. Don't know how I feel about that. Like if it's legal, it's fine. But like it's just so illegitimate to me.
Yeah.
You know, like, no one fucking bought that. You bought it yourself so that it would look more valuable in the market.
That's scarcity, right?
All right. I mean. Scarcity, yeah. I would never do that, but that's me.
Yeah.
I want people to genuinely want to own my work. That's how I want to make my money. It's like from people who actually want to own my work,
right?
Not as an investment. I mean, my work's not an investment anyways, but like if it was, you know, like I want people to like enjoy it. It's like reading a comic book, you know, like there's those people that like just buy them, bag them, board them, and they think that it's gonna like
accrue
value. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. They don't read them. They don't enjoy the stories. And I want you to enjoy I want you to enjoy my work. I want you to look at it and hang it up and, you know, enjoy it.
How is your work received in Vietnam? Do you have any idea?
I have a vague idea. I've heard from a few people. Do you know Paul Christensen from The Saigonier?
I've heard of him.
Yeah. So he did an interview with me last year, and he kind of shared his work with some of his colleagues in Saigon. And from what he told me, it got really good feedback. Apparently, he was like, you know, when you come back here, bring some prints, let me know, and I'm going to get an order because there's some I've talked to a lot of friends who want to like buy your prints.
Have you ever been to Vietnam?
Born there and then didn't go back until 2019.
Oh, okay. So recent.
Recent, yeah. Recent-ish. I was born there in 79. We left when I was two.
And like, you've never shown in Vietnam or exchanged money for your art?
No, not in Vietnam. Most of my market is the States. States and then Canada. And then after that, just like Europe in general. Like I've had customers in UK, Germany, France. I think the closest I've shipped to Vietnam was Singapore. I had a couple sales in Singapore.
Yeah. You brought up something in a few sentences ago. You said something about your work is not, or your art's not investment yet, or something like that.
Yeah.
When does that start to happen in the world, in the life of an artist? Like people start buying it as investment pieces.
That's up to the public. I could control it, I'd make it an investment now.
What dictates that?
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, what dictates, what triggers that that way of thinking in the public?
To be honest, I don't really know. I think it's just demand, right? Like you get on the right projects, you get the right eyes on it, you get the right people to promote it. That's not always the case, but like those are always big factors. And more people see your work, more people want it, and you just become more prolific. Like you look at James Jean. You know the artist James Jean?
No.
He's just killing it. He killed it in the art. I don't even think he does it for money anymore. He just does it because he wants to now. He started out, I don't know where he started out, but he did a lot of covers for DC Comics back in like the early 2000s. Then after that, he just started like, and this was on top of his own personal work too. And then he just started doing more of that. Gain more notoriety, and then I think he had his art officially printed on Prada or Gucci or something like that. I can't remember, but one of those like
mega brands,
money. Yeah, the mega brands.
Yeah,
and he just like, blew up, and yeah, now he's living the good life. And his work still now, it's so different, but you can tell he's gotten so much more experimental, and I think it's awesome. Like his work is still really good, but now he's just doing it for the joy of it. It seems anyways. Like I don't know personally, but that's what it seems like to me.
I have an observation. It's like when I think of filmmakers, artists, chefs, whoever are who are making, creating, I think of your early days, first years, as you're putting things together, but it doesn't have the signature mark of a Brian Hwang, right? It doesn't have that like specificity of your fingerprint in there yet, right? Your DNA.
Right.
And I think as you go along, the DNA of the way, like as a podcaster, like I'll ask questions. Oh, that's his signature, or that's his way. But you don't develop that shit until you're like at least 10,000 hours, as Malcolm Gladwell says, right? Into it. And then slowly, if you get to be prolific enough and you're doing it enough, then your fingerprint starts to show up in people's minds, like automatically. It's like, holy shit, that's him. That's Kanye. That's whatever, right? Even just listening to the beats of what he produced, you're like, oh, that's a signature thing. And I think that's like every art form is like that. It's like, you know, you can put a blindfold on somebody and you're like, you know, whoever is like eating in these high-end environments, they're like, oh, that belongs to chef so-and-so or whatever. That, you know, right. Once you get into that world, you begin to say, oh, that's a Brian Hwang, you know, and you don't even know, there's no, you know, you don't even need to see it. You just can tell by the lighting, the coloring, that's a signature, that's Brian, you know?
Yeah, totally. And you do develop that during the 10,000 hours, you know? Yeah. It's just after the 10,000 hours, it's like when you've kind of like, hit it. And then after that, you hopefully continue and evolve. But yeah, it doesn't just happen. You do have to kind of, like you said, like the fingerprint slowly forms, evolves. You experiment. Because like when I first started drawing, I've been drawing since I was a kid. So, but like when I started taking it seriously, like during college and all that stuff, all my work looked like, you know, Jim Lee, because that's why I grew up collecting. I collected his comic books, you know. You kind of see everyone has developed this gimmick, so you try to develop that gimmick, and then after that, you take pieces of everything, and then you make it your own. So that's how it happened with me.
Yeah. I can't wait to see more years of where you're taking this, because right now it's phenomenal. And I feel like you've done your time, but you're also growing, because you could see the trajectory on Instagram, and it's beautiful. It's amazing.
Appreciate
it's amazing
that.
Journey.
Yeah. I'm hoping to, like, because like, you know, you bring up music and stuff, like you look at some bands, they have like 5-6 albums under their belt, and no one gives a shit about them until like that 7th album, and then all of a sudden,
boom,
you know,
overnight success.
Exactly.
7 albums in, overnight success.
Right.
15 years at it, and it's an overnight thing.
Well, I know you're a big Tupac fan. He kind of hit it big when he started he signed up with Death Row, right? Like when he started working with Dre and stuff. Like, I think that's when he hit his stride.
You know, I was just looking at a TikTok on Tupac the other day, and it was like the young, super young Tupac, very eloquent, speaking in a way that's like, you feel like he's a college student, and he's talking with so much respect about women. And then like, he talks about how Jada kind of like, didn't give him time of day, where she's like, you're not a bad boy or whatever. And then like a year later, you see the before and after, the after video, and you're like, he starts using the B word, describes women as bitches, just makes that jump into becoming, you know, and as an artist, you know, whatever happened to him, that evolution took him in a totally different, weird way. But, you know, having bumped into Jada, that's what happened to him as an artist, you know, getting spurned by her.
And that's the thing, like art comes from all these influences and life experiences, whether negative or positive. And man, it's crazy. And then you look at it does, but then there's also just like a natural creative evolution, right? So there's that where there's just this jarring, like this shit happened to you, and you just went in this other direction. But then over time, you continue on that path and you evolve. And like you look at, and using another like group, the Roots, they start out kind of like jazz, like all live music, but just very hip hop, right? Yeah. Like really just Philadelphia hip hop. Mm-hmm. And now you listen to them, they're just, but these guys are amazing musicians. Like they've always been, but like now they're just like, another level. It's not just hip hop. They like infuse everything, jazz, rock, like, and on the spot too, you know. I don't want to bring up the Roots because Black Thought's like one of my favorite rappers ever. So, but yeah, it's incredible to like listen to that, how you can have a jarring turn of about face with your musical style, but then you can also have this slow growth. And I think that applies to like art too, like anything creative, really.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And I think what we're talking about is sort of like a dexterity, you know, there's a dexterity when you add it long enough that you can, what you're talking about with the Roots, their dexterity, their mental agility to do their creative craft is on another level because they've done it so much.
Yeah. Perfect word for it is dexterity.
Yeah.
So speaking of music though, like what are some of your favorite musicians? Like what did you grow up listening to?
I grew up listening to a lot of different music, Vietnamese music, a lot of country music. Grew up predominantly. Say again?
Never had you pegged as a country guy.
Yeah. Well, being in the Marine Corps, you know, I was around a lot of country music.
Yeah.
George Strait, Garth Brooks, Leanne Rimes. A lot of, you know, I went to a Garth Brooks concert by myself in 96 in San Diego. Dwight Yoakam. I mean, yeah, you name it. I was really in the mix with country music. There's a sort of a parallel to Vietnamese Paris by Night music and country music, because the chord progressions and the simplicity of the, you know, there's no dissonant chords. There's no, like, you know, jazzy notes. There's no syncopation. You know, there's not a lot going on. It's very simple right. music.
Yeah.
Although the themes are a little bit different, but the simplicity is the same. So there's this instant connection with country music when I was exposed to it. Then
that's awesome that you connected like the Vietnamese music to the country music, and that's where you kind of like that's how it hit you.
Yeah, the simplicity of the messages, and you know, I listened to a lot of opera growing up. After college, because, you know, I took vocal classes and, you know, singing, and so I have an appreciation for opera. And, you know, my favorite vocalist is probably Andrea Bocelli. He's not really an opera singer, but, you know, pop Italian opera, pop opera, if there is that category. But yeah, Andrea Bocelli is Andrea Bocelli and Elton John are my two favorite vocalist when it comes to music. And then a lot of rap, because I grew up in the inner city. There is a real distinction between West Coast people and East Coast people. I cannot get into East Coast rap.
Really? Eh?
Yeah, it's just the weirdest. Thing for me, man.
Going through that, I was like, I mean, if you're talking about like just the labels themselves of like Death Row and Bad Boy.
Yeah,
I always kind of sided more with like Death Row, just because I like Dre's beats. I thought he was such a beat maker. But man, and I know that they weren't part of Bad Boy, but I also really dug Nas and Wu-Tang and, you know, all those guys. So it's kind of hard to pick. I think you like good music, right? You just like,
yeah, but there's a weird thing when like you hear you know, Snoop and Nate rapping about 2-1 and Lewis, you know, and that's a street corner in Long Beach. And it's like, I'm half an hour from that corner.
Yeah. Or,
you know, raps about Crenshaw, you know, all these West Coast, you know, Dr. Dre raps about Crenshaw. I grew up like a 5-minute walk to that those intersections. And so there's this sort of connection that, you know, for me, as a West Coast, you know, kid in the 90s, I gravitate towards. And Tupac, you know, his lyrics just reach out to me in a certain way that I can't connect with Jay-Z. You know, I can appreciate the genius of a Nas, or even the Roots. You're talking about the Roots, and I'm like, yes, they're the dexterity, the virtuosity of these musicians, but I still can't get into it. You know, it's just not. My Biggie, I can appreciate the genius of Biggie, but for me, it's like it's always going to be Tupac, because that's just the familiarity of Dr. Dre and Snoop. You know, Snoop, Dr. Dre, and Tupac will always be my the triumvirate.
I love those. Yeah, but you bring up a good point too. Or it's like there's like skill and talent, but there's also like connecting with your audience and their. You know, they're separate, they're together, but they're also separate things too. Like, you know, going back to the art thing, like I've seen so many incredible artists, like on Instagram, on, you know, like just learning about them, collecting comic books, all these great illustrators. But why do some stick out to me and the others who are possibly even more talented? I just don't pay as much attention. Them? Yeah, I don't connect to them. There's a connection, and I guess for you it's like geographical, and that's something that counts. Like I know for me, like I don't, coming from Toronto, I don't really care about Drake, so for me it's not a geographical thing. but there's just something in the what they sing about or the music, like, I don't know. Like, I obviously can't relate to their life experiences because very different from my own, but maybe it's the passion they sing it with or the way it layers on the beats that it's just it's unexplainable connectivity, right?
You know, yeah, geography is a weird thing, man. I you know, I'm gonna say this. This sounds really woo-woo, you know, it sounds really funny, but okay, so there's a specific dialect in Vietnam in Saigon, right? Mm-hmm. There's this weird and I'm not saying that I can nail it every time and hear it and nail it like, oh, that's where you're from, but there's this weird familiarity when a woman or a man speaks with me from Vietnam and I go, yo, where Vietnam are you from? And then they're like, Phu Nhuan, right? And there's this, it's in Saigon, it's somewhere near District 1. And mm-hmm. and it's just weird because if their families, you know, grew up there in the 70s, 80s and 90s and 2000s, there is a way that they speak. And I can't describe it. I don't know how to describe it. But every time I've asked, and it could be a mental thing where they say Phu Nhuan, and I'm like, that's a majority of the my mother's family grew up in there's a train track that goes through Phu Nhuan. And I can just hear the train tracks when they say Phu Nhuan, like any stranger. And the way they speak, it's just a way of speaking that I feel so at home with my aunts, and I can feel like them making bansae in the kitchen as the train goes by. Cause mm-hmm. you know, in the early 2000s, late 90s, when I went back to Vietnam, that's sort of like the kind of imprint that I got. I'm like, whoa, there's a lot of people talking like my mom and her siblings in this particular region of the city, right? This is right. Tiny. And so every time I hear somebody speak, I'm like, oh, where are you from? And they're like, there's this easygoing way of speaking and from people from Phu Nhuan, that area. And so, you know, it's this weird thing that I have with geography. Same thing with Tupac and Snoop when they're rapping about these, like this 10, 20 mile geographic area that I grew up in. It's like this familiarity mm-hmm. that we have that we connect.
Yeah, to. You know what they're talking about. Yeah. You know exactly what they're talking about. So, you get it. But so kind of touching on the accents, though, can you understand when someone speaks Vietnamese with a northern dialect?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Northern. I can't. Yeah. Like, I can pick out words. I can understand certain words that kind of like enough to kind of get the gist of things. But man, like with me to understand Vietnamese, it's so specific. Like they have to speak basically like my family speaks. They have to have the same accent as my family. So like when I listen to your Vietnamese interviews, I understand you perfectly, but I'll watch some YouTube videos and you know, they're like northern dialect and my wife will be like, what they say? I'm like, I don't fucking know.
Yeah. It's you know, you get into some of the central highlands or whatever, at that you get lost because they're just so different from what we're used to. You know, there's some parts of Australia or Ireland or Scotland that's they're speaking English and you're like, what the fuck? You know, it's same thing. Yeah, it's the same thing.
Yeah, I used to know this guy, John Boyle. He was Irish and I could understand him when he spoke, but when we went out drinking, and he would like, you know, three beers in, I'm like, I don't know what the hell you just said to me. I like, we talk about music a lot and he's like, blah, 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 The Cure. And I was like, that's the only word. I was like, so does he like The Cure or he's not like The Cure? But it was English, but not, you know what I mean? And that's how I kind of feel when I hear Northern Vietnamese accent. Like I can make out words and I can make out, you know, enough sometimes to get what they're talking about, but I would
There's an evolution of language in English, Vietnamese. What, you know, there's evolutions of language in pockets of the world in Vietnam that evolved without even some people in Vietnam and Saigon probably don't understand that local, you know, colloquial, the vernacular, the local vernacular is not understood to people in the South. So people in the South don't get it, how the fuck are we going to get it in the West, right? Vietnamese diaspora, it's almost impossible.
Well, I heard, actually, it might have been on your podcast or another podcast, I can't remember, but isn't there this like theory that like, or maybe a study, where the diaspora has kind of like just clung to the old language, where, but sure. in the homeland, it's evolved past that. But what we heard was when we left, right? So we're still speaking like 70s Vietnamese.
Yeah, and there is also a distinction between the 70s Vietnamese, the Hanoian accent and the Saigonese accents too. Mm-hmm. So there is a sort of like frozen and, you know, fossilized Hanoian 75, you know, of Tai Tang and Kang Lee, you know, that's the singers who are speaking a specific Hanoian dialect that the South spoke differently, that's frozen in time. And it's very elegant and beautiful to listen to. That when you go to Hanoi today, it is not even reminiscent of it. It's just very different. So yeah, it's a beautiful thing. I think it's such an amazing thing to have all of this part of our colorful Vietnamese history and heritage.
For sure. Like, I think just language in general, right? Like it's a living thing. It evolves with the generations.
Yeah. And your art too. Yeah, your art, you know, art. I think when my kids get to a certain point, they're going to look at it and they're going, oh shit, in the 20s, which is right now, not the 1920s, but the 2022, the 20s, Brian's art within the 20s, this is what that looked like. This was his interpretation of the world from his eyes.
Well, I'm hoping people still talk about my work 20 years from now. Yeah, I'll be happy if people are still talking about my work five years from now, you know?
Yeah, if you don't stop, people will, yeah, of course. You know, if none of us stop and we just keep creating until the day we pass out, you know, I think we'll,
people will talk about it. That's my plan. Yeah. Yeah, that's my plan for sure.
Yeah. Well, Brian, today was, you know, I always learned so much talking to, you know, artists and creators and, you know, thank you so much for opening up and telling me about your work and life.
Thank you for having me, man. Like, can I be honest for a second? Like,
yeah, of course.
Well, bringing this up, I wanted to thank Juan Lee for introducing us. That was great of her. So I appreciate her doing that. But when I got that email from you, I was like, because I mentioned this before, I'm familiar with your podcast. He probably just wants to like look into like some like artwork or something. And then when you ask for an interview, I'm like, this guy's had some pretty named guests on. Like, what the fuck am I going to talk about? Like, so I didn't bore you because you had some names on your podcast. So I was quite surprised when you asked me to be like part of your library now.
This whole idea of like, and I deal with it too in my own head, like, I think fingerprints, right? If we can examine these fingerprints in all of the creators that we talk with, it's just a matter of, who's been working at their craft to get their own fingerprint sort of like in clear focus, right? And
yeah,
where you catch these artists or creators in their journey of their process of creation is wherever you land, right? Like I'm landing here today with you this year, this time, and I get a snapshot of that. Somebody like Viet Thanh Nguyen is on a different continuum of his, and I got to catch it at that point in time and have a discussion with him. All of it to me is beautiful, no matter where the artists or the creators are, or the politician or the historian.
Right.
So I am so invested in seeing where that snapshot of that evolving storyline or that fingerprint is in the history of the Vietnamese. So I want to just put it for the record. It's like, I will continually do this no matter if the artist like yourself is, you know, being recommended by somebody like Wan Lee, or somebody who nobody knows about, but I'm interested in the formation of that DNA pattern or that fingerprint pattern. And I want to, obviously I'm going to study and research a bit about your work before I reach out or ask for the introductions. But every artist, whether they're starting out or they've been at it for a long time, it's very interesting to see that, you know, it's like catching a young Tupac. I'm not saying you're a young Tupac, but I'm just saying, like, God, if you can catch a young Tupac or a young anybody, a young human being,
an old anybody,
just to capture these patterns of thinking is magical to me.
That's awesome, man. I love that. Yeah, I love that analogy. I love the everything. That's great. Having commented on that, it's just, you know, you try not to compare yourself to the success of other people because that's just a distraction. And I try not to do that. But, you know, I want to have something interesting to say when you bring me on, right? And these people you brought on have very interesting things to say. So, I appreciate you, like, having me on, man. Like, truly. It's awesome.
Yeah. I think that everybody has so much interesting things to say. I really do, but you know, I think I'm biased because I love humanity and I love the small stories, the little nooks and crannies that we don't get to see often. So whether it's a big story, big personality, or small story, small person, all of it is, for me, there's no sort of I don't make distinctions because I could spend 100 hours with you, just like I can spend 100 hours with my kids. I can spend 100 hours just with humanity because there's just the process of where you, what you've gone through to get to the work that you've done is already just a mind blowing, journey to if you think about it, right?
Thank you, man. I appreciate that.
It's valuable.
Everyone's got a story, right? Like, no matter how big or small it is, everyone's got a story. So,
dude, even if we were to talk about your 10 years as a mini bar attendant, I bet you that there are things that I could spend maybe 3 hours just talking about that, you know, that 10 years. Easily spend 3 hours with you talking about the mini bar world, you know?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, for sure. Like, you know, on paper, it sounds like so boring, but yeah, no, stories come out of like being a minibar attendant, you know, or just working at a hotel in general. Like there, you get some interesting guests sometimes and, you know, employees talk. So yeah, I've got stories. If you ever want to do a podcast on my minibar experience, have me back on.
Brian, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate your time.
No, I appreciate you, man. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, cool, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Awesome.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcast. Thanks again for listening.